months. And in that time, the liquidators appointed Standard Bank to be a transaction advisor. They had to come in and basically value all of the assets, create the necessary contracts and environment for people to tender to purchase these assets from whichever source. Standard Bank did do that. Data packs were created, portfolios of the mines were created, and subsequently people were invited or companies were invited to tender to purchase these mines. This process commenced around about June 2009. In that time, Free State was sold, and we'll get to those sales now, but Orkney and Fruitfly were not yet sold. They were still in the process of, or their people were still in the process of being tendered. During that end of process, the liquidators were approached by Aurora Impairment Systems, who submitted a bid to acquire firstly Orkney Mine for 200 million rand, which was in, it was for 290 million rand, which was in more or less July 2009. And then later in September, they put in a similar bid for the Fruitfly ones. Now, to revert just quickly to those three sales, and to deal with Free State first, if the honourable members have regard to paragraph 2, this figure here is wrong of 56 million. There's an updated report that it wasn't calculated, it should be 400 million. But the Mossigold Free State was sold, and the existing mine dumps. I have an outdated report. This was the one that you have is the one that will be more accurate, and you'll see it paragraph 2. No, it's fine. Everybody else is okay. The existing race rock dust was sold for 20 million, the plant was sold for 100 million, the north mines were sold for 100 million, and the south mines were sold for 100 million. Now, if you have regard to the further paragraphs of that report, more succinctly paragraph 2.3 and 2.4, you'll remember I explained to you that there are three classes of creditors. The first class that I explained to you is a secured creditor. This is a creditor that has some sort of bond over the movable property, mortgage bond, or a notarial bond over the movable property. Now, in terms of the rules of litigation or liquidation, they usually get their money first, and if there is anything left after they have been paid, then it goes to the preferred workers, and then only does it go to the concurrent creditors. Now, the IDC has alleged to have security over the assets of the Free State mine, as well as the Orkney mines. That security is in dispute. There's a long legal battle between the IDC and the liquidators about that security, and that has not yet been resolved. However, at the time that the mines were sold, the IDC consented to an advance dividend of approximately 67 million rand being paid to the workers. Sorry, Mr. Chair, somebody's got their hand up.
Thank you. It seems that if this conflict is just received, it's not in line with what
I appreciate that. I try to explain that my report on my computer is the one you have in your hands is the direct one, if you can follow with me on the test. Okay. Which one is that? Okay, hang on. Let's fix this. Alright, that should be the direct one now. Okay. For us. Now, just to resume my point. So, in other words, from a liquidator's point of view, there is a conflict between two classes of creditors. The IDC say they have to get money first because they have security over the assets, and the workers say, no, the IDC has no security over the assets, and because we are preferred, we must get paid first. So what had happened as an interim measure at the time is that the IDC together with the liquidators consented to dividend being paid to workers of approximately 67 million rand, and at that time, they took care of all of the arrear salaries of the workers at that time, and also paid a portion of those people that received benefit and retrenchment packages, that also took care of that. Now, in respect of the Orkney and Goodfellow mines, we now have the introduction of Aurora Empowerment Systems. Through the bid process, they were appointed as the preferred bidder to acquire those 2 mines. Contracts were signed, the bids were accepted. It was now in July 2009 for Orkney and September 2009 in respect of Kutla. Subsequent to that, okay, let me just explain the structure of the bid. What Aurora did is they said, we will re-employ everybody that's on the mine, but we want to structure our deal with the liquidators in one of two ways. It will either be a compromise with the creditors of that mine, which means that they go to all the creditors and they offer them a certain percentage in the rand, and if the creditors accept it, then the balance of the debt gets written off and they get over the mines and they carry on. Alternatively, for a straight-out purchase of the Pamosi mines. In terms of the bid document, that was to occur in February 2010. In the meantime, and because the liquidators had already borrowed money to operate the mines on an interim basis and did not have the funds to continue this indefinitely, the transaction was made with Aurora Empowerment System in terms whereof Aurora would take over all of the staff, all of the operations, all of the profit share of the 2 mines and operate it until such time as the compromise and or purchase of the assets has been completed. Now, therein came the problem with Aurora Empowerment Systems, because about 3 months after they took physical possession of the mines, there was a general strike, and the liquidators then ascertained that there was a problem with Aurora's funding, to such a degree that the workers were not being paid as it was undertaken to the liquidators, which obviously led to the strike, and there were some problems communicated to the liquidators about the actual funder or funder coming through, which then caused the mines to go into care and maintenance. Now, care and maintenance, as I understand it, is a process whereby a mine keeps a minimum amount of staff for sole purpose of preserving the assets and ensuring that the statutory minimum statutory safety requirements are met in terms of the relevant legislation. That continued between April 2010 to May 2011, when the Joint Provisional Liquidators cancelled the agreement with Aurora and took back possession of the mines. And when these mines were taken back, it was found that a lot of the assets had been destroyed or dissipated, and clearly there were a lot of problems whilst Aurora was in position. What we have now, or what then resulted, is that we had to sell what was left to whoever so wanted to buy the shell that was left. And now in respect of Free State, the liquidators did good, quite well, and the entire mine was sold for 150 million rand, if you refer to paragraph 3. Once again, the dispute of the IDC security is on the same basis as the one in Free State. That matter is still pending. There will be litigation about this, because I seriously doubt that the IDC will just walk away from this. But we will, and we are currently in the process of dealing with that. In regards to the East Rand companies, the balance of the assets was sold for an amount of 70 million rand, which is the immovable property as well as the mining data. We'll see that how that is set out. Now, the mining data, as far as my memory recalls, and I'm speaking under correction, I think there is something like 4.2 million ounces of gold reserve proven at Kirtland. The problem with those gold reserves is that the mining operation to extract it is, and I'm by no means a mine expert, but it was explained to me that it is quite expensive to extract it. So at the time that the gold price was $480 an ounce, $490 an ounce, it was just not viable to continue that mine. However, when the gold price started increasing to over $1,000 per ounce, then it became actually quite a profitable mine. Unfortunately, the reserve is still there, And in order to extract them, you know, we're going to have to, or whoever has bought it, which is Gold One, would probably have to reinvest and recreate the infrastructure. But if you have regard to paragraph 4, you'll see that that is how the sale of the assets basically being grouped by the liquid assets. Now, obviously, an estate, an insolvent estate, does not only have a asset, a physical asset, as something that it can sell. It also can recover claims on behalf of these companies, and the liquidators are duty-bound to attend to the recovery of these claims. Now I want to take you to the Commissioner's report, which refers to the inquiry that was ordered by the Master. Obviously, the Honourable Members will appreciate that when the Aurora transaction was cancelled in May 2011, and it was found that a substantial portion of the surface assets had been destroyed and or sold, and it was found that the surface infrastructure of the mines was no longer there, the Master was very concerned and immediately ordered an inquiry to be convened into the affairs of Thawani in order to ascertain what exactly it was that happened. The inquiry commenced in August 2011, and the former directors and controllers of Aurora were summoned to appear, as well as various other interested parties like former employees, former mine managers, suppliers, and things like that. The reason for this is that the Master ordered the liquidators to find out what happened and ordered the Commissioner to report to the Master on exactly what occurred and how the situation went from having three operational mines to having one operational mine that was sold, one operational mine that became semi-operational that was sold, and one mine that was, for all intents and purposes, destroyed. What we strategized, and we just start, Mr. Chair and Honourable Members, in fact, out of the main interrogator in the Viva Motsi inquiry, and I must explain why certain avenues were followed and why certain avenues were not followed. When we retook possession of mines, there were no records left. All of the records were destroyed. The computer systems had been corrupted and all destroyed. So we had no way on paper to follow what occurred. We had to prepare our inquiry based on interviews that we had with mine managers, gold smelters, and we had to reconstruct the events which occurred in the time of Aurora from viva voce, or oral evidence only. We could not compare it to any source documentation. The only source documentation we were able to obtain, naturally, were the bank statements of Aurora. Because the bank statements we sought from Standard Bank, who were their bankers, directly. And we got, I think it turned out to be something like 6,000 pages of bank statements, which we got from the Aurora group of companies. And from those, we were able to identify certain transactions. And we concentrated initially, and I'll get back to this, only on the EFT transactions, because the EFT transactions usually has a reference number or a reference person, and you can then immediately pick up where it went to. Where you have a situation where checks are written out, it's very difficult to trace where the check went to unless you have the check that comes back from the bank. This can be done, but it is a forensic exercise for which the estates simply did not have the money. Now, when we extracted the bank statements and we took care of only the EFT and the transfers we could trust, we noticed the following. That is that coming into the bank account of Aurora during the period of October 2009 to April 2010, an amount of approximately 122 million rand had been paid by Rand Refineries. We went to Rand Refineries and we obtained their documentation as to why this 122 million rand was paid to Aurora, and we found that this was for gold sales. So this was money generated by Aurora at the time that it operated the mines, which gold was sold to Rand Refinery, and Rand Refinery paid them. Then we picked up approximately 35 million rands worth of transfers that were made to various individuals, which we then summoned to the inquiry because we wanted to know why they were paid, bearing in mind we have no source documentation. And then they give an amount of approximately 262 million, I think under correction, 259 million rand, which as I sit here now cannot be traced. The reason for this is simply because there's checks for round numbers. When I say round numbers, as an insolvency interrogator and insolvency investigator, if you are handed bank statements, you always go to the round figures first. In other words, a check that's written for a million or a check that's written for 2 million, because you'll find that suppliers usually are registered for that and that never are their invoices, nice round figures. So you always concentrate on the nice round figures and then try and trace that. Now, as I sit here now, in right now round figures, there is approximately 259 million unexplained, which we are still tracing. All right. Now, if I can refer to the report. The commissioner proceeded to interrogate parties. As you'll note, in the first portion of the report, it just identifies the witnesses. It identifies... I just want to open mine. Just give me 2 seconds. Alright, if you have regard to basically pages or paragraphs 2, come back to me. Basically just states the history of the commencement of the inquiry, records the fact that NNET had obtained an order from the High Court to record and broadcast certain portions of the inquiry. It's important for this committee to realize why this needed to be done. In terms of section 417, read with 418 of the Old Companies Act, a report of this nature is always secret. And there are two people, two entities, who has the power to release these proceedings. One is the High Court and the other one is the Master. As the Chair, you will recall that Master has conceded and this report was provided to the inquiry. Now that happens in terms of section 417 sub 7. So NNET had to go to court and ask the court, given the fact that they were of the view that the proceedings in Aurora were in the public interest, whether they could record the inquiry and broadcast it. The liquidators opposed this application for the simple reason that certain of the witnesses had communicated to us that they were being intimidated by the controls of Aurora, and in certain circumstances or instances, they were afraid that they would be physically harmed and or their families would be harmed. The Master took this step very seriously, and the application by NNET was therefore opposed. The court then made a compromise and refused NNET the right to record any of the testimony of the workers, but consented that the testimony of the Executive Committee of Aurora, insofar as they gave testimony, that would then maybe recorded and broadcast. And I don't know if the Honourable Member saw, but it was actually broadcast on the program quite much. Now, if regard is had to paragraph 3, it's just simply the identity of the witnesses. Firstly, you have obviously the what we refer to is the Executive Committee of Aurora. That consisted of Mr. Kulubu Sizuma, Mr. Zorro Mandela, Mr. Tulani Gubani. And the first three gentlemen were recorded on CIPRO as being directors and consented to act as directors of Aurora Empowerment Systems. The following two gentlemen, Suleiman Faisal Garner, I will revert to, and Yassine Teva I also revert to. Mr. Hali, there appears to be a lot of confusion as to whether he was a director of Aurora Empowerment Systems or not. Mr. Hali was interrogated. Mr. Hali denied that he was a director of Aurora. the CIDC officers lists him as having been registered as a director of Aurora for a period of one day. I have seen media interviews where Mr. Hali has acted as a spokesperson for Aurora. Mr. Hali has indicated to the committee that whatever he did for Aurora, it was in his capacity as an attorney or as a board advisor and not as a director. Further confusion has been caused, and I'll get back to that a bit later, because at the moment we are currently involved in litigation with all of these parties that you see in paragraph 3.1, and Ms. Faisal Bana and Suleiman Bana as well, Sulani and Gubani, and Mr. Mandela, have all stated under oath that Mr. Hali was a director. The reason why this is relevant is for nothing else other than the fact that being appointed director of a company has certain liabilities accruing to it in terms of Section 77 of the New Companies Act. Director of a company is always liable for the affairs of that company if those affairs are conducted recklessly. We are in current, or I hold instructions to investigate, a petition claim against Mr. Hali, as we did with the other gentleman, which I'll get to you now. But that's sub judice, and there's really nothing happening in that regard at the moment. In regards to Suleiman and Faisal Bana, these two gentlemen, and you will go through the report later, appear to have been on the Executive Committee of Aurora Empowerment Systems. However, they have denied this vociferously. What they have said is that they were merely advisors to the board, that they took no executive decisions of any nature whatsoever, and that the debacle which came to be known as Aurora really had nothing to do with them. They were just sideline advisors and really didn't have anything to do with the management of Aurora. If you go then down to paragraph 3.2, those are the employees of Aurora, with the exception obviously of Mr. Hilliard Plessy of Solidarity, who also testified, and then the gentleman Keith Harpali, Smith and Brett Toy were also not employed. The rest of the gentlemen were all employed on Aurora. And then we got to Reclam, which is the castle, except Jane Crane for my offices, and then Sandra Detroit on Standard Bank. Yes, and Mr. Lateef also was an attorney, but I'll get to all of their testimonies just now. I just want to identify them for the present purposes. The following witnesses were called, but who did not appear. Mr. Bashir Musa. We had information that he was the accountant of Aurora. He was also a family member of Mr. Faisal and Suleiman Bana. However, we could not locate him, and our investigators told us is that he currently resides in Dubai. The master has no jurisdiction over any witness outside of the borders of the Republic of South Africa, so it would have been an exercise in futility to issue funds for this person. Mr. Anthony Shamas was all equally a difficult man to find. He was subpoenaed. The sheriff did serve the subpoena. However, despite this and despite several follow-up requests, he's refused to testify. Then lastly, Mr. Enver Mutala. Mr. Enver Mutala was an erstwhile liquidator of Komodi. Mr. Mutala raised a legal objection to testify in that he was in the process, and I believe he's still in the process, of challenging the master's removal from his office. And that he raised the objection that until the court or the High Court had decided on that objection, that it would not be competent for him to be interrogated at an inquiry. At the time, the liquidators decided it would be a futile exercise to go into a lot of litigation with Mr. Mutala, which probably would still be pending as I sit here now, just so we proceeded with the inquiry without him. It was just not economically viable to get him to come to the inquiry. Now, if you have regard to paragraph 4, you'll see that the master has given a very specific mandate to the commissioner. The master ordered the commissioner to hold the inquiry and then revert to the master on very specific issues. Now, in paragraph 4, it basically records or deals with the issue of Mr. Mutar and Mr. Gainsford's removal from office. I'm going to leave that portion of the report to the master. I was involved in their removal. and I think that would be better for the Mazda to deal with a bit later. Be that as it may, there previously were six liquidators, and after the removal of Mr. McCullough and Mr. Gainsford, four remained, and the four joint provisional liquidators, they immediately cancelled the ITCA and terminated the agreement with Aurora. This is going back before Aurora's existence, which is what I explained to the committee earlier. This is paragraph 4.4 and 4.5, where we tried to operate the mines. We got money from AVB Bank while we were looking for a buyer, and then we eventually found the buyer for Free State. That agreement was completed. Then we found the buyer for Orkney and Groenland, which is Aurora, which is what I'm concentrating on for the purposes of this presentation. Now, if I may refer this committee's attention to also paragraph 4.12, I have dealt with the appointed directors of Aurora. Now, in July 2009 and October 2009, Aurora entered a written bid for the acquisition of the Grootsteen mines and the acquisition of the Orkney mines, respectively. This bid document became the cornerstone of all our future investigations. And at the time, Aurora came to the Mossi liquidators and to Standard Bank and to the Master and said the following. This is 4.12 is a direct quote, or this comes just out of the bid document that Aurora submitted to the Mossi. At the time, Aurora said, our directors are Mr. Kulubuse Zuma, acting as chairman, excuse me, Mr. Michael Hulley, a non-executive director, Mr. Zondwa Gaddafi Mandela, who is the managing director, Mr. Shishi Lengubani, who is the executive director, and Mr. Ratu Dato Zainal Alam Shah, who is an executive director of Malaysia. I will explain Mr. Shah's involvement a bit later. Also in the bid document, Aurora said that they had purchased 71% interest in a company known as Senmec Limited, which is a company that was listed on the stock exchange, and that this acquisition was in line with their plans for more transparency on the highest level and corporate governance on the highest level, etc., etc. They didn't deal with the fact that Mr. Shaw was their funder. They give a brief background of Mr. Shaw. They state that he was a knighted by the King of Malaysia and that he was also one of the founding members of the Bank of Islam and all of that. It needs to be mentioned that we have yet been able to get a hold of Mr. Shaw, never been able to find him whatsoever. Then, the document further states that Aurora had acquired the largest sawmill in the southern hemisphere, which is Redwood Timbers, which I believe was in Zambia, and that this acquisition had propelled them to the forefront of the global market in respect of commodities, with the core focus now shifting to mines. Aurora stated in its bid document that it had very strong links to the Gulf and Far East, and it was positioning itself, as I stated, as a major player. It then said to the Pomosi liquidators that it was the most suitable operator, since it had a long-term view, that it would be resuscitating Pomosi, and it would maximize its stakeholders' interest, which basically came down to that it would offer its workers a share percentage. It stated specifically it would not retrench any of the employees, and that it could fund capital expansion programs of 150 million rand at Orkney and 200 million rand at Grootsteen. Now, this must be noted that these expansion programs that were told in the documents were over and above the purchase price, which they had bid for the acquisition of the mines. Aurora intended, it could fund social labor plans, it was well capitalized, and the acquisition would be structured, as I said earlier, either by way of a 3-1-1 compromise or an outright purchase of the mines. Now, having received the bid documents, now the two bid documents for Orkney in July 2009 and the bid document for Grootsteen in September 2009, the verbiage or the content of these two documents were almost exactly the same. So it was either one was used as a template for the other, but it absolutely had exactly the same wording. they were signed by Mr. Mandela, and the liquidators at the time then referred this company, Aurora, as a preferred bidder to Standard Bank for ready. Various problems were encountered right at the inception with the vetting process of Aurora. The address of its funder in Malaysia turned out to be somewhat dubious, in that the address given by this Mr. Shah as where he is, where he holds office, later transpired from Standard Bank that it was a boardroom that could be rented on an hourly basis. So that didn't work. The next address that was given to us apparently was in the Petronas Towers in Malaysia, and we have since ascertained that those towers are for the exclusive use of Petronas Petroleum and not any other company whatsoever. At the time, Standard Bank raised its concerns with the liquidators, and these concerns were vetoed by the then liquidator, Mr. Mutala. Be that as it may, excuse me, Mr. Chair, just have a little bit of technical problem with my computer. Okay. In terms of the deal made with Aura initially, it was then structured that IDCMA, or Interim Contract Mining Agreements, would be concluded with or between Pamotti and Aurora. You'll recall, Mr. Chair and Honourable Members, that I informed you that at the time, this is now 2009, the liquidators thought firstly it would be in the best interest of creditors to keep the mine operational so that we can get a potential price as a going concern, and secondly, we didn't have the money to keep these mines operational unless a creditor was willing to fund us. We had approached HVB Bank a second time to continue funding us, which they refused, so we had to get the preferred bidder or whoever was going to acquire the mines to take over the mines immediately. This was a matter of necessity at the time. Aurora, having represented to us that they had all the capital, that they could fund expansion programs, that they had sufficient money to pay for not only the acquisition of the mines but also social and welfare programs, it was then decided to conclude the interim contract mining agreement with Aurora so that they can continue operating the mines, generate a little more profit for the estate, and then obviously acquire the mines. You'll remember, or I must just mention, that the bid document stated that the three-element compromise would occur by no less than February 2010 at that time, which is a question of a period of 4 months later. The liquidators thought it was an acceptable risk to wait the 4 months and have them carry on. During or in that ITCMA agreement, Aurora undertook to protect the mines, to ensure the mines, to pay all staff, and generate gold proceeds, and these gold proceeds would be shared with the liquidators, who would then be able to pay further dividends to the creditors. During February 2010, there was a general strike by the workforce on Aurora, and it went then into care and maintenance, as I stated before. Now, can I just please concentrate on the bid document for now? When we called the witness to the inquiry, and we obviously took the bid document, and we went through each and every representation that was made to the liquidators in terms of that bid document, we ascertained, and all of the directors of Aurora confirmed the following, that they had no money whatsoever at the time they entered the bid document, that they had not in fact acquired CENMAG and or Redwood Timber, that they had in fact not raised the financing of Mr. Shah, but that this was subject to some sort of condition precedent which had not been disclosed to the liquidator, that Aurora in fact had at the time loaned monies from certain what they called investors simply in order to make it meet and in order to pay the deposit that was required by the liquidators. These monies had to be repaid together with a commission to these investors. Now, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, if you understand insolvency law, you will now realize that Aurora was therefore insolvent from the very moment it opened its doors, because it loaned money from people and owed them back more money without having acquired a single asset. So now the company was basically insolvent from the beginning. What then happened is, during the time that they operated the mines and they generated 122 million rands worth of gold sales, these monies were not used to pay workers and their creditors. These monies predominantly were used to pay back these investors, who at the time were basically making almost double what they had invested into Aurora. So you had a situation here where you had three or two full operational mines, the workers were working, people were generating funds, generating gold, gold were being sold, but the proceeds were not used, like any other normal company, to pay for its overheads, to pay for its workers, to pay for its supplies. In fact, it was used to repay these investor friends of Mr. Solly and Faisal Dana. What we had ascertained at the time, because we've driven a timeline between the unions and what we're doing, is that at that time there's various pieces of correspondence where Aurora director had written to the unions and said, just hang on, we're getting money in shortly, we're getting money in soon, which was never paid to the unions, but in the meantime the monies were siphoned off to these investor gentlemen. Understand now, when I referred to the investors, only the 35 million rand we could trace. It might be a hell of a lot more, I just don't know, because there's 252 million rands worth of, or 259 million rands worth of checks that we have not been able to know where those funds went to. We're still in the process of investigating that. When the mines now went into care and maintenance, what you had is you had a staff complement of about 120 people. These 120 people took care of the statutory requirements to make sure that the assets aren't damaged or anything like that. During that period, which is April 2010 to February 2011, Aurora then started, let me put it to you this way, we as liquidators received a report in August to say that assets are being removed from the estate. At that point in time, the liquidator dealing with Aurora was Mr. Mutala. We addressed this concern to Mr. Mutala. Mr. Mutala related to us that they said denied and nothing of the sort is happening. By November, we had raised disputes with Mr. Mutala, which disputes were submitted to the Mata, where we sought the immediate cancellation of the agreement with Aurora. The master then conducted an inquiry, which they will deal with, and that culminated in the end in a removal of Mr. Mutala and Mr. Gainsford in May 2011. 1 week after Mr. Mutala's removal, the agreement with Aurora was cancelled. We retook possession of mines and then found that a lot of the assets had been destroyed or dissipated. In our inquiry, we found that there was an illegal mining problem, because Aurora did not pay the security contractor that was charged with protecting these mines. The illegal miner became a serious problem. They, in fact, I once saw a mail from Herbie Fowle, the mine manager, who pleaded and said they've become a law unto themselves. Even calling the police did not help, because there were just too many. Approximately 2,000 cases of theft, criminal cases of theft, were laid by the liquidators against various nationals who came in and looted the mines. However, we are not aware of what happened to these cases. I don't know whether they have been prosecuted or not. When the liquidators took over, they immediately put in a new security contractor and normality was restored. However, in investigations, we found that not only was there instances of illegal mining and illegal looting on Promosi, but also that transactions had been concluded between certain scrap dealers and Aurora Empowerment Systems, in terms whereof these scrap dealers were allowed to end at the mines and remove assets. In this one, in Lovu Shaft, which was a new shaft built for, I think, 42 million rand 3 years before, was completely dismantled and removed, together with all its compressors and wonders. Circular Shaft was completely dismantled and removed, together with all its compressors and winders. Number six shaft, was removed. Number three shaft was a pumping shaft, an irrigation shaft. The workers removed those pumps because they were afraid that they would also be sold to Regan, so those have been stored, and we still have control over those pumps. But because of the removal of those pumps, the irrigation shaft now stood still, and we started to have a serious pumping problem or irrigation problem in the area. We have interrogated Regan, and we are instituting action against Regan. However, we have the following difficulty. We estimate that approximately 110 million rands worth of assets have been removed by RECAM, but there is no way of proving it. Because there was no security contractor at the time, it is impossible to decide or to determine or to differentiate between what RECAM took and what the illegal miners took. It's just not possible, and the court's going to want to know that detail. So in the end, our quantum has been reduced to 5 million, which is the amount that RECAM paid to Aurora for the purchase of these assets. And because RECAM knew it wasn't Aurora's assets, we can now claim that 5 million rand back. And that is what our claim has been reduced to, unfortunately, in law. Insofar as other scrap metal dealers go, we really haven't been able to trace a lot of their stuff because the scrap metal industry is notorious for doing their transactions in cash. There's no real paperwork. Witnesses don't obviously want to come and testify to what they bought and what they didn't buy. And we were stuck only with RECAM because RECAM kept a measure of record of what they bought. Now, if I can now give a brief overview. Sorry, I've departed from the report because I'm going from memory. I think it's easier. If you now look at the position of the liquidators, we have four sets of claims, four things that we can recover on behalf of the creditors, which includes the workers. The first is a claim against the directors of and controllers of Aurora in terms of Section 424 of the old Act and 77 of the new Act. These acts say a director or a member of the executive committee cannot conduct the affairs of a company in a reckless manner. If you do this, then you, in your personal capacity, are liable for that company's debts. Now, you will recall that the bid document, which they submitted, and which all of the directors, including the controllers, which Mr. Faisal and Solbana admitted under oath during the inquiry, that none of those representations were true. Not a single thing in that document was true, except maybe for the appointment of the director. Now that is deemed by law to be reckless. We have then instituted our action against Mr. Zuma, Mr. Mandela, Mr. Mgwani, and the two Barnas, Mr. Faisal and Solbana. The reason Mr. Hali not included in that is because at the time that we instituted the action, we were not yet sure of his role, whether he was acting in his position as a director or whether he was acting in his position as an attorney slash advisor to company. We have since been handed documents or affidavits by Mr. Mandela and Mr. Ngubani and the Chivanas to confirm that he was a director, so we are proceeding with that now. The quantum of that claim, Aurora's liability at this point in time, is approximately 1.92 billion rand. This consists of the 122 million rand gold sales, which Pelosi wants back and wants accounted for. And then there was a valuation done approximately 3 months prior to the liquidation of Pelosi of all its assets. The collective assets for those two run at about 1.8 billion. Now, obviously, from that figure must be deducted the 150 million rand sale, as well as the 70 million rand sale, which subsequently occurred. So if you then look at the 1.292 billion less the 230 million, that would be your quantum. Now, if we are successful in our application against Mr. Zuma, Mandela, Mubani, and the Barnas, then their personal estates would then be declared liable for that amount, and we will then seek to recover it. So that's point one. Have a moment, Mr. Chairman. Can I just finish with each one till the end? Okay. All right. That matter was enrolled for hearing. We instituted that action in 2012. That matter was enrolled for hearing before the North Gauteng High Court. In August of this year, approximately 1 week or 2 weeks before the hearing, all of the respondents applied for a postponement, stating that they did not have sufficient time to prepare, stating that they didn't have money for attorneys in the case of Mrs. Faisal Solibana. But basically, what it comes down to is that they received a postponement against the cost order by the court, and the matter is now being enrolled for March of next year. In that scenario, Mr. Ngubane and Mr. Mandela, as well as the two Barnards, filed opposing papers in which they gave us their version. And in the version, it ostensibly comes down to the fact that they had been lied to by Mr. Shah, that Mr. Shah wasn't who he said he was, and never gave them any money as he had promised, and it wasn't the misrepresentation contained in the bid document cannot be laid before or in front of their door simply because they were also lied to. Mr. Chair, this is a sensitive subject. I don't want to. We will defeat that defence, but I don't want to now because it's sub judice. I can't really deal with that right now. Mr. Zuma has filed papers, interim papers, to say that look, he wasn't really involved in the management of the companies. And I must just state to this committee, my interrogatories have confirmed this. Mr. Zuma is correct. Mr. Zuma wasn't on the money. Mr. Zuma basically was a face of Aurora. He wasn't personally involved. He never wrote out a single check. He was not involved in a single financial transaction of Aurora, save for monies that he had actually put in from time to time when workforce would sell behind. So in Mr. Zuma's, to Mr. Zuma's credit, what he says is correct. He wasn't involved. The difficulty that Mr. Zuma faces is that in terms of law, a director of a company cannot claim recalcitrance. It's just not something you can do. If you are a director of a company, you have to be involved in that company. And if you're a director of a company, you have to check that it's being run properly. So our case is proceeding with Mr. Zuma, however, and this I can't talk about either, is that we are currently in settlement negotiations with Mr. Zuma to see if we can settle his claim. Then we will proceed with actions against Mr. Mandela and Mr. Barna, Mr. Albano and Mr. Hull. Okay. Now, the second claim that the Aurora, or that the policy liquidators can reclaim, but this is in the hands of the Aurora liquidators, is now the monies that were paid to these investors during the time that the strike happened. You will recall that I said to you, Aurora is insolvent from the get-go, which means that any payment it makes to anybody has to cannot refer one creditor over another. And in insolvency law, the workers were preferred. They had to get money first. But in that time that they were supposed to be paid, these investors were repaid their capital for interest. We launched that application also in 2012. That also went before the court in August of this year, and the court pronounced judgment. We got the judgment against these investors. They've been ordered to repay the money. Since then, each one of them have launched rescission applications, which rescission applications raise the following defenses. They say, A, that the master should not have admitted the claims of the workers in Aurora, which would have admitted the claims in Pomotsi. Two, that Aurora never had any workers, that all the workers were still and remained in Pomotsi, and it had nothing to do with them. And three, is that they know that they were repaid money, but they also put money in, and therefore we cannot claim it back from them. Now, once again, those defences will be defeated. We are simultaneously launching sequestration applications in respect of each one of them. These will likewise be heard in March of next year. The reason I say it's in March of next year is because there's a case manager being appointed. In terms of the rules of court, if you have a very complex case, and it is 10 or 15 different matters, and they all pertain to the same people, and they all have the same plaintiff, then you can appoint one judge. The reason for that is you don't have 15 different judges reading the same papers. So the one judge was then appointed, Judge Backelsman, and he will then hear all of the matters in March of next year, including the sequestration applications, which we intend to launch for all of the other gentlemen as well. Now, once we recover these monies, this is now the problem, once we recover these monies, then we want to go and investigate the 259 million rand that I spoke to you of earlier. The states simply do not have the money to appoint forensic auditors at the moment. We don't. And every cent we spend, we have to carefully account for because it's worker monies. We need to get this money in. We can't let these people go, but we also don't want to be over litigious and spend too much money on litigation and forensic audits, and in the end, have 90% of the proceeds go to liquidators' lawyers. We are very careful that there must be a substantial dividend that must go to the workers and to the creditor. So we have sought the assistance of outside parties to help us identify or help us fund a forensic investigation, but you know, find investigators or funders of that nature in these circumstances is extremely rare. Alright, so that is the second portion of it. Then the third claim is the one of the one against Switzerland. Those are common law claims. You bought my assets when you knew it wasn't yours to be purchased and you paid for it. The quantum of that would be at most 10 million. So you, of the 26 claims, which is the investor claims, they have 35 million. One more thing I also have to mention is that one of the payments that we tried to set aside was also made by Aurora to Mr. Mutala. He had apparently loaned Aurora 3 million rand and was repaid that money 2 weeks or 3 weeks later. Be that as it may, it is a disposition that has to be set aside, and we have launched that application. It hasn't been heard by court yet, and we have not yet had the benefit of Mr. Mutala's defense. Then the last piece of litigation that we are involved in are the criminal matters. Now, I must apologize to the committee. The criminal matters have not been included in my report because I was concentrating on the money aspects of things, and I didn't really have regard to the criminal side. The liquidators have launched or have laid two criminal charges. The first criminal charge relates to the following. In February 2010, when Aurora were staged that they weren't paying their workers and could not pay for the mines, we addressed letters, the liquidators addressed letters to them, placing them on terms. We then received a letter from a Mr. Cully Smith, who is an attorney on the West End, who said that he had 20 million rand in his trust account on behalf of Mr. Shah, who is the funder, and that this money would be appropriated and that once the Pamorsi assets were transferred. And since ascertained from Mr. Smith, that he never had that money in his trust account, that he never acted for Mr. Shah, and that he was asked to write that letter by Mr. Faisal Bana, with the view of placating the liquidators who wanted to cancel the transaction. In that same period, which is March 2010, Mr. Arnold, an attorney from Durban, addressed a letter to the Security Regulatory Panel of the JSE, reporting that he had 5.4 million rand in his trust account for minority shares in the acquisition of the Labatt transaction, which was going to be a funder. We have since ascertained that that letter equally was false, that there was no money in Mr. Almut's trust account. In fact, at the time that he wrote the letter, he did receive a check 2 days later, signed by Mr. Mandela from Aurora, of about 4.8 million rand, but that check was cancelled the same day. So we are currently awaiting the outcome of those two criminal cases which we have raised, and other than that, I don't have anything really further. Let me just, Mr. Chair, might I have 2 minutes just to go through my report, or can we take a break? I just want to make sure I have covered everything before I give the microphone over to Mr. Russell.
The other option is, suppose, is that we can continue. If you remember, you want to add, we can still go to that. I would prefer that we go and break when we are done, so that we can do much better with information.
All right. Well, the conclusions contained in the report, if you look at from paragraph 5 onwards, these are the conclusions that are made by the commissioner, where he states, in summary, what I have just told you, where he states that, look, there's no doubt that the controllers of Aurora acted recklessly. There is no doubt that actions must be instituted against them to declare them liable for the deaths of Aurora. He also states that there was a uncomfortably familiar relationship between Mr. Mutala and the Bana Group, and he seeks the master, or he recommends that the master investigates that issue. He also recommends that the Section 26 claims, which is the investor claims that I told you about, that they be recovered. And then he also recommends the actions be instituted against the reclamation group for theft, and also that various instances of theft and fraud be investigated. Now, that is a recommendation made to the master. It's not in the hands of us as liquidators to lay those charges, and I'm sure Mr. Basson will deal with that issue of what happened there further. However, insofar as the estate is concerned, the commissioner also recommends that the conduct of the liquidators be investigated, and what they did or did not do, or were supposed to do and were not supposed to do, that, likewise, I will leave to you, Mr. Basson. I have really nothing further to add. If you've had regard to the report, it's quite detailed. I've said to you in summary everything that is contained therein, and I'm willing to take any questions that you want. You'll remember my little report, which is the 5-pager that goes supplementary to this. It's basically just summarizing what we have done after this report. So if anybody needs a question, please, I'm willing to answer. Thank you for the chair.
Okay, thank you. Master?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, by and large, we have already submitted what we have to say. I think the only point that we want to highlight to the committee is what were the actions taken by the master against Mr. Mortala, and how far are we with those actions, and what are the latest developments around those issues. I'll ask the Deputy Master, Mr. Siriso, to please address the House on it.
Thank you. Subsequently to Mr. Mortala's removal from the Pamotsi matter, he approached the High Court to review the master's decision to have him removed, and also, you know, he wants to be reinstated on the matter. Currently, and I think he started that case already in 2011, shortly after he was removed. Currently, the matter has not been heard. There were various papers that were requested from the master, which was provided, and so on, but the matter is currently sub judice, so I cannot really comment on the content thereof. The next matter that is currently being dealt with by the master is that Mr. Mortala issued a summons against the Minister of Justice and myself for 150 million for loss of income for the past 3 years. We are still, that was served on us 2 months ago. So we are still in the process of dealing with that matter. Thank you.
I guess you're done. Okay. Let me go back to my... Okay, honorable members. I'm sure it's like you are listening to some type of a movie that can't be described. But you are allowed questions of clarity on the information submitted. Welcome back. Honorable Smith and Honorable Shafter. Honorable Smith, it seems only your hand is here. Honorable Norma, the Chief of the Suppers. I didn't get the name of the... I don't want to say honorable member.
I'm a bit Renee Mashabela.
Oh, Mashabela. Honorable Mashabela and honorable Piginini. You know, the others will do as usual. Let's wait for them to go through their common practice. Honorable Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report, in terms of section 417, the report which was provided, the section 8 report, is a tremendously complicated report. and you can see it's various court cases, issues, allegations of fraud, theft, blatant theft. I don't think I've ever seen a report to that extent, and allegations voluminous, if I might put it that way. I mean, 600 million rand worth of fraud. But so it's difficult to, you can get embroiled in the detail very easily without seeing the bigger picture. And I'm still trying to see the bigger picture. And the bigger picture seems to be that Aurora wasn't Solomon's right from the start. Aurora does talk to the, does not own any assets. And the world, on the face of it, doesn't own any assets. So normally liquidation proceedings are there to ensure that there's some form of return for the creditor, whether it's 13 cents it was at some stage, and it's not gone up, I believe, 20 cents, whatever, it's a different standard. I understand that the process is not only against Aurora, but it starts it off right from the start with Morsi. And we've heard before him coming to the committee saying, listen, Harmony is doing an excellent job because it has a running enterprise, at least at that stage, I think still has. And Aurora did exactly the opposite. But my concern is, and the first question that comes to mind, because I see the liquidator, Mr. Walker's kind of refers to it quite often, is payment of the employees. I did see in one of the documents, one of the various documents, that payment was made, or that money was made available. It's 57 or 67 million.
So 67.
67. So I think the first question would be is to when have the workers in terms of Grootsley, Orkney seems to have been, I get the impression Orkney is kind of dealt with because the Chinese company seems to have purchased it for the summers in Cajun. And that at least, although it's subject to all other kinds of, but as a run concern, it is being maintained, it is being run. Is that a correct assumption?
That is correct.
So the biggest concern is basically Grootsley, the East Rand. So we can accept for the moment that the employees at the Orkney mine have been paid, or relatively paid because it's a running concern. So, firstly, is the employees in terms of the Orkney mines to be dealt with? Is there issues in that regard?
Honourable Mayor, you must remember this is an extremely difficult question to answer in law, and that's all I know. When the liquidators handed possession of the mines to Aurora, at that point in time, if you take a picture of the employee situation, they were paid up to date.
Yes.
So at that time, they became employees of Aurora. Now, the situation with the worker claims, which I constantly refer to, is not the Morsi problem, it's the Aurora problem, because that is a mess. And there are claims that have been submitted by the workers in the Aurora estate. But as you have correctly stated, there is not one single asset in Aurora. The mines that have been sold were sold in Pomosi. And those proceeds went to Pomosi. And you are quite correct, Orkney is operating again. But even the 70 million rand, that was paid to Pomosi, not to Aurora. In fact, Pomosi is Aurora's creditor. So Aurora has paid its workers because it can't. It doesn't have any money. And we are trying to recover these claims in Aurora in order to pay the workers. Now, if you note from the liquidator's report, in Grootsley, the administration costs, which in terms of Section 89(3) of the Insolvency Act, is already in excess of what 70 million rand is. But there's no claim by workers in Aurora City because they were paid in full. If you understand the time that they went over to Aurora. So the worker is being banged about a little bit by the legal entities of these people, but we are bound by law. We can only do what the law tells us to do. Until we get money in Aurora, the workers are going to have a long wait, and that's why we were very excited about the victory we had in August. But now they've come with applications to rescind, so now the workers have to wait another few months.
And unfortunately, law is a frustrating process. So if you want to know what the worker claims are, all in Aurora, they are arrear salaries due to them. There are retrenchment and those packages due to them, but there are no assets in Aurora.
Can
I think just sorry to assess it. You know, my problem, I don't want my meeting to run as if I'm not in the chair. Don't steal my meeting. Keep my meeting with me. Can we allow, with your respect, let the honorable Smith ask, I don't want to use a language that I may not be entitled to do. There's something called our learned friends. Because they are learned friends, they can keep the record, just record those questions. In the event there is no clarity of purpose in the response, we will then allow the Honorable Member to make that follow-up. But let's just get an understanding of the question first. And then if in the response of the team, the member is not satisfied, we will then give the opportunity to do the follow-up. It will help in terms of the flow of the meeting. It's not a question of oppression. So I will request that we use, that's what we usually do, just use the keeping the records. So every question is asked. I will help if you forgot the question. I will do that.
Mr. Chair, my apologies. This is my first time here. I don't know what you're asking.
You couldn't do anything in my meeting except my usual colleagues in this house. So I was just reminding those. Okay. No, you can continue, Honorable Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I just say, I understand that there's seemingly millions of rands outstanding in employees' remuneration. If you compare that to the alleged secured creditors' claims running into millions, I suppose I saw one figure, 1 trillion, if I recall correctly, 1 trillion to 1,000 million, it would extinguish any possible income you ever could consider. But that's I know it's been, I understand, if I recall correctly, that it has been disputed. But having regard to all the secured creditors of those, at least the three, to the extent to which they are disputed or not, considering the value of the estates of those who you intend instituting summons or have instituted summons, the Barnas and the Shari confined, I'm just trying to get behind the purpose of it, because I can understand section 424 would be to go after creditors, that's a criminal charge, say reckless sparing or whatever, not reckless, right, behavior. I can understand that there's a reason to wind up the estate, especially as far as first place is concerned. It's something like you're running out to the bus, now you've caught the bus and you don't know what to do with the bus, because the claims have just escalated to such an extent that a continuous, I'm not saying you shouldn't, I'm just trying to get to a point where there has to be value in the creditors, for the creditors. I mean, they have first creditors meeting where they have to lodge claims and prove their claims, etc., etc., etc. So, for an overarching point of view, because we can continue the whole day on minute issues, what's your primary goal in terms of those four claims, section 424, the claims against the controllers and the directors personally, etc., etc.? I mean, against CINMEC, against one company that was the scrap metal dealer, 10 million small change. So is it for the purpose of what? Because the secured creditors are going to snap up the whole content. So can I just, I'm just trying to see the overall picture before I get to the more smaller detail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Honorable Larimer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's a very similar question to what my colleague has asked, and it's probably slightly unfair, in that I'd just like to get an opinion on what you think might eventually come back to the workers. what proportion of what they're owed, and give us a big case and a worst case. The second area is what I'd just like some clarity on. Almost 4 years after its fraud was discovered, it's called one of the most serious frauds in South African history. And I'm not hearing a lot about criminal charges laid. Criminal charges against the directors, could they follow against those investors? Are they in progress against Matala? What about reclaim? As a third issue, and that kind of relates to that, and you may not, you said you didn't have an answer to this, and it's really something, Mr. Chairman, for the committee to consider. We were told about 2,000 criminal charges against looters. I'd be very interested to know from the Director of Public Prosecutions whether or not they have followed any of that up. 2,000 is a lot of charges. And another area which is also for the committee to consider, I believe, and that is, again, not for the purposes of this meeting, but wanted to flag it, I'm interested to know that despite the BMR saying, I don't know, we must make sure this can never happen again, it seems to have happened again at Black Racelift, even involving some of the same people, the Bonas. I want to know what the BMR has done or has failed to do about the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm covered by the question of Mr. Smith.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mind Chair, I think we really welcome the report. I think the report is quite explicit. It's a detailed one. It's what we've asked for. Mine, I don't think we had to really continue hammering some questions to you. I'm really, you know, it really talked to Chef with the report that we received last time. It details, you know, it gives you really what does conquer. I think when the process is where it is now, because we are coming fast with this one, I think we are about now to reach, you know, an ending point. Now, without wanting to score any points now, I really wish to say that I think this work, it was really difficult to deal with. And we went so far, now we are able to get some kind of details that will assist you to carry on with the work that you are busy with. Now, it's only, you know, I mean, example, the mask is only in March that we had to get on in court and proceed with that. Now, ours, I think it's important that when the mask is received, subject care, it's ours to get the report and then the process and get some kind of clarity, as my colleague asked for, you know, and then you verify those and then you proceed with the work that you're doing. Mine, I think we are really dealing with the work quite profusely, and I think that's really to say that we are looking after the state, you know, resources at the end of the day. I think it is really, to me, it is in good hands. I think the issue is here, it was not easy to get some kind of information which was needed. And therefore, we are able now to come closer to that, and there are some kind of cases that are there and that have been dealt with. Now, in my view, I think that's really allows yourself to deal with the matter and the manager dealing with it, and then you keep us updated at all times. That's really my wish to say that I think really at the end of the day we'll get some kind of clarity and where some money would really retain. And I think I'm sure the matter you're looking at, our worry always will be the workers. I think, you know, it's quite a long time now. I think these are the issues that you must be dealt with and make sure that at least there's something to eat at the end of the day. Now we'll move further to say, let's make the point that even the state will intervene where they can. That's to that matter of, you know, social whatever, social upliftment, assisting the workers so that they're able to live whilst they're waiting for their resources. I really wish to do that. Thank you very much, sir. The usual suspects. Yeah, the usual suspects.
Honorable Mafolo, Honorable Mandela.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also join my colleagues to welcome the presentation. I think it's for the first time we have been hearing about this thing of Aurora, Homozi, or Nivea. But today it is we have an insight, and we know what to tell our people in our different constituencies. Especially most of our employees who are working there are from different various sessions or zones. So I just want to know if you really update them as you are telling us, how usually you meet with them to inform them about the process so that they don't, it doesn't mean like they have been neglected, they don't know anything, but what we are talking about their future. But also just to join honorable beginning on commenting on a good job. We are behind you, we'll only support you. Let the Lord take its course. Really, we appreciate the report that you gave us today. We have an insight of what is happening, and I'm sure we'll help you to account, even if you're talking to those workers. We are having some families at our different constituency who want to know what are you doing as members of parliament. At least you let them to know that something is coming. At least, and there is a light on the tunnel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also thank Master and the Provisional Liquidator for the report and the presentation they have made. Chair, it's worth applauding, and I feel coming from a province that being the Eastern Cape province, which contributes by far majority of workers in mines, this subject for me needs to be attended to and needs to be dealt with. I would like Chairperson to find out in terms of the master and the provisional liquidators being here in Parliament, what do they regard to be the solution to this matter in terms of the portfolio committee? How do we bring this to closure, and how do they foresee the involvement of this portfolio committee? I would really like to gain an understanding in terms of our own role, what is their anticipation in being here in Parliament and presenting to the portfolio committee. Is it an informative exercise for us to know, or is there a solution they are trying to drive the portfolio committee to? Secondly, Chair, in terms of looking at the solutions, how are we to look at closure to this matter? I think it's been going on far too long. It's been in the media and public space for far too long. How are they seeing this matter being brought to its finality and closure? I know they have talked at length about the matter being in courts, but I'm just looking in terms of portfolio committee and us as a member of parliament, how can we bring closure to the matter and know that we've done or that we could have done to ensure that the public were informed of this process. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Probably can I also just thank you.
Yeah, the usual perfect as well, sir.
No, I can't speak before you speak. I think in the report, just to assist the committee. First, I must say that I recognize in the report last week, and I think somewhere in the submission now, there was a process that was being undertaken as reference to, which is, I think that's what also Honorable Norma was talking about, to the NDPP as well as to the SIU. I'm not sure that the status is still the status of what was presented last week, that the matter is still a matter that is being proceeded, being dealt with there. But let me say, it's good luck. You were allowed to make criticism of us. But before we could make criticism also of the justice system, because as I told you, I was once told by one lecturer, don't question the law, you must ask the law. Now, questions will begin to arise. And I think the master can help us on this one. Reading through the report, because we sit and our understanding is that part of the master's responsibility is to ensure that there is protection of the vulnerable from financial and legal matters. Now, listening to the report right through, and I think there is a concession also even in almost all the three reports. But the report of the commissioner's report is almost much more succinct. That you have somebody who has got a previous conviction. I dare a dodgy character. Now, the question then arises, how then becomes possible that such a person can be given that responsibility? Is there no device mechanism that could be able to set alarms on these matters? I think this issue, I may be wrong. This issue has been here, I don't know how many times, in this committee. The veterans can speak, but looking at my records, the DMR, the Department of Minerals, has been here on this matter. The trade unions have been here in this matter. What worries is that the only time, and I think in the report also that is submitted here, there is a concession that says, I tell you again, some noise was made long before about what was happening. And only in 2011, this dodgy character is taken out. Surely something could have been done much more earlier than... What were the hindrances that made it so difficult to act as much earlier as possible? I think one of the other things is what members, I think generally, can help as to what lessons can be learned, because whether we like it or not, the lessons to be learned, what lessons can be learned out of this whole matter of Pamotsi Gold. Is there a process, for an example, out of this experience, is there a process where there is something that sometimes is done, that when people are appointed, and I think it will lead to also part of what one honorable member never raised. First, is there a process currently that is underway to clean up the list of insolvent elements? But also linked to that, is there a process that is being considered? For example, sometimes when people are placed there, you say, here is the group of liquidators. Is there any person who has an objection to this individual and came to motivation that, no, this one, I know who has done this. I'm taking this also in line with the question that was asked here, the place war. That if you look at the place war exercise, the one will say, surely the liquidators of place war could have been informed as early as the 23rd of September, 21st of September 2013. And we wouldn't be having that problem, because it would have been clear that some of the people given that responsibility are cited in the report as dodgy characters, if one were to use that word. Or some would be treated as dishonest in the process. Will that be a wrong assumption to make? But given the fact that, and I think we will get the response, the response from yourselves around some of these issues, in particular the issue of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, I will take that point. But I think I wanted to, there's something that one can't get. I don't want to use a word, because some matters I was told they are sub judice. But with the fact of the matter, with this level of looting, I can't get a sense as to where are the loopholes. Can you get an advice? For example, if the loophole, I know, it doesn't mean, when we went for the oversight, we told the officials of DMR that sometimes what they thought were preventative measures, they were signals that were assisting illegal miners. So every time they put something as a sign for data, they see it as an opportunity to mine, because it means there's mining active below. So we can't be, when you deal with something, there will be no process of those trying to devise new mechanisms. But I mean, what failed us here? Is it the law? Or, I know I'm not going to say, we look at the law, I doubt that there's been a breach of the Companies Act, but the breach of the Companies Act, me, sitting here, made me ask a question. Was there no weaknesses in the Insolvency Act? I know it doesn't fall in this committee, but surely we deal with matters that if that law is not strengthened, I'm just reading that thing. Is there something that we need to look at it? Because in the final analysis, and I think I must say this, honorable members, with all the respect I have, in the final analysis, what will close this matter is when justice is done, one. Two, what will close this matter is when the committee, that is what the responsibility, begins to look as to whether the statutory limitations that it seeks to look at, or that it seeks to recommend to other committees that are supposed to make. For example, one would say, if the process in relation to the recent submission that now there is a court case by the Enver Motara, whom at some point was Dawood. We started that report was Dawood. Now, surely it begins to say, we might find ourselves in the Justice Department in that problem because of the safety nets. Because if we detected this character from the way it go, probably we wouldn't be in the problem now. So I'm just trying to say, what could you identify that, because the committee will be difficult to discuss the cases, the litigations and so forth, except to do what Honorable Mafola will say, and I think when we discuss, we'll come to the conclusion that continue with the good work, make sure that everything is done, that those workers should not be the ones that are in the receiving end. But I'm saying, we have got a statutory responsibility on this side to make sure that legislation is consistent with what now can prevent this matter. Is there an opinion that you could abuse the quality with to prevent such matters in the future? Where are the weaknesses or gaps or things in the legislation? Is it in the MPRDA? Is there no problem with the Insolvency Act? Is there no problem with the Companies Act? Is there something that you would recommend for the committee to consider?
Just allow me to try and structure our responses, and I will ask some of my colleagues and the provisional liquidators to answer on some matters. they say with hindsight even a fool can be wise, and I don't think we should underestimate the opportunity to analyze and then investigate what could we do better in terms of our laws to improve. And I am not ready, Chair, to make the final submission on proposed amendments right now. And we ask, I will ask permission to either in writing or in person report back at the conclusion of the majority of the court cases, so that we can know what is the final position in matters. Perhaps at that point, and then with the benefit also of the litigation and the judge's decisions, be able to amplify what could be done better. Just on the issue of regulating and tidying up and catching out unwanted characters beforehand, I want to inform the House that there is currently a process in a very advanced stage where we cleaned up the list of liquidators. There was, when we started the process, about 1,500 people on the master's list, and that list number has now been reduced to 570. So we've taken out 700 people. Things that we were looking at in cleaning up the list is the response to an 80-page affidavit by these applicants, where they set out their background, their exposure to workers' rights, their criminal records, their whole detail. And we have that information, and we've published that on the Master's Department of Justice in the category of Master Civil Law. So the approved candidates by now is published on the internet, and we are welcoming any comments on the suitability of those people that have now been regarded. We are not, however, satisfied as a department that we've reached the end of our endeavours. The Department of Justice is considering the admission requirements and standards for practitioners in the insolvency industry. We call it regulating the industry. We are also in the process of considering adjustments to the insolvency legislation, consolidating the process in companies and in close corporations and individuals. So the insolvency laws are in the process of being reconsidered, and for the also special focus on the vulnerable and also credit insolvents with smaller amount, smaller assets. Not only the big matters are receiving our attention, also that. So the cleaning up of the list and the objection, the legislation, the regulating of the industry, those are matters currently. In fact, one of the big efforts, not only to clean up but also to transform, is the Minister of Justice's policy on the appointment of liquidators, which seeks to achieve a significant cleaning up of the process, as well as transformation, special focus on women, and in particular black women, as identified. So there is that process underway. The process is also subject to litigation in terms of the constitutionality of that transformation efforts. The process is before court. The judge, the matter has been argued, and the judge is to give judgment before the end of the year. So there's an ongoing effort in terms of cleaning up, transforming, and evaluating the situation. The master is satisfied that within the current laws, we can do things as expose Mr. Motala and remove Mr. Motala. We removed him in 2011, around about, I think, September. 3 years plus has gone by, we've not seen the inside of a court. So we are ready, and we will deal with it. But one thing, even though Mr. Motala now sues us for 150 million, he is not going to be appointed. So we, within the existing laws and existing mechanisms, we have been able to deal with not only Mr. Woodbine, there are several other liquidators that have been removed in this process. And it is not only removing people that have done wrong, but also they are holding the remainder of those liquidators liable for losses they've caused. So ongoing is very sensitive, but we are in the process of also calling up the bonds of security that these liquidators have failed. Creditors are relatively protected against the wrongdoing of liquidators. So where the liquidator, where the director of a company did wrong, he can be held liable. Where the liquidator did not do a proper job, the liquidator can be held liable. The liquidator do not get appointed without providing a bond of security to guarantee his or her conduct. And we are in the process of instituting those actions. Why do we do it? We are passionate about the position of our workers and dealing with their situation. I just want to say, therefore, our laws provide for recovery, and our laws so far have proved effective. It's unfortunately, like any litigation, not something that you can step over the counter and buy a decision from a judge. You go through process, a burden of proof. The provisional liquidators have explained to the committee sometimes how difficult it is to get these documents, and now you've got to go through processes to establish these facts. But I'm comfortable that these matters have been receiving undivided attention as the processes unfold. May I deal with the criminal matters? There was some concern about the criminal matters. The issue of the 2000 claims, what do we call them, cases, is not quite within the department, the master's environment, and it's a matter that should be best answered by the National Prosecuting Authority and the police, as how far these investigations have gone. The sense that I get is that those are very difficult matters to investigate and to follow through. It touched the whole sensitive area of illegal money, which is not something that is within the master's domain to answer. I cannot really speak to that. But illegal mining is something that appropriate people should be able to answer as committee. Unfortunately, the master cannot help with it. What I can give the house assurance, although the miners are normally spoken for by the trade unions, despite that structured avenue of communication, I personally meet from time to time with minor groupings of workers, and we try to explain to them the processes that we are taking. It's very difficult to explain to a hungry person, well, the court has ruled that the liquidator after transaction is impeachable and must now be recovered, but it doesn't mean that the moment the court ruled in your favor, the cash is on the table. You now have to go through an process. We are in the process of recovering funds, but at least the lines of communication are open. When, although there's the structured communication, we go out of our way to facilitate. I found a constant willingness by the provisional liquidators to also explain to them the process. Sometimes it's difficult for the workers if they work at the same place. Today you're working for policy, but because of some paper changing in the admin office, you're now working for Aurora. It's difficult sometimes to explain that, but in law that's what's happened. Pomochi closed, paid everything, and then Aurora comes into this into play. And then, so workers, it's difficult to understand why whoever the boss is not paying. It's a difficult thing. I appreciate the fact that this house and other oversight structures keep on asking and keep on demanding a response from us, as well as the liquidators in this regard, so that we do not stop paying full attention to the matter. Would any other legislation have helped and put workers in a better position? I really don't think so. Your problem is this picture that was painted of many millions in this company's hands was a fraud. And you cannot pay people with fraud money. That's what exists. It's the difficult certificates by attorneys that they hold certain amounts of money in their trust account being false. It's unthinkable that for the normal person will normally rely on that. I'm trying to explain other laws won't be able to avoid it. It's, we cannot change. We've given workers a very good position in terms of preference, in terms of notice, in terms, and I think the legislature has done very good in terms of the laws. It's the fruit behind it that's the change. As for that, in terms of wrongdoings, remember this commissioner's report is before the National Prosecuting Authority. The Special Investigating Unit proposal for a proclamation by the President is under consideration at the Presidency. Therefore, this matter, the law is taking its course. I can ask the committee, please allow us for the process to be completed so that we could come back and say, here it is. We are not aware of any unfair or unnecessary delay at any point. As I said, these are complex matters. It's not something that one can just dismiss overnight. If I can just try and then deal with the question. As I said, the level of looting and those are difficult issues because it's often individual behavior. Sometimes we do not know where's the divide between a worker waiting for his salary dividend or salary payment through this long legal process and seeing some reserves there that he can go and help himself to, and the dynamics in those situations. I don't think any law could improve that situation whatsoever. In terms of the blefer and dodgy characters, we are confident that a significant step forward has been taken with us cleaning up the list of liquidators. I cannot take that matter any further to say this is ongoing business. It's ongoing. If one of my colleagues may have a little more on Blyfour, we would do it. I was not properly prepared on Blyfour. Okay, I think, firstly, that was majority responding to the issues you've raised. In respect of the issue that how do we bring this whole matter to closure? How can we stop and bring to finality? I think you noticed that a lot was done and a lot of matters is in the final phase of litigation and there's an ongoing litigation process. I really think the measure taken by the judge president in combining the actions in one is a very considerable step forward in bringing matters to a close. I can see that the litigation and the closure of these processes are now really in its final stages. What can the committee further do to assist? I can only reiterate. If it's measured, it's done. If you say to me, Master, I want the report at this station, at this station, at this station. The master will get to the role players and stuff. Can't come to the committee and say it's a work in progress. Therefore, the oversight function of the portfolio committees is of great value to us in the administration to keep us honest in terms of staying focused on methods. So I think it's most valuable for the committee to enforce your oversight responsibility. I say that with the greatest of respect. We appreciate that. I still think the legislation, please let us make proposals to you closer to the finalization of processes. We will likewise share that report with our own portfolio committee in the Justice Cluster through the appropriate channels. Our Director General, Deputy Minister and Minister, and the Cluster Ministers, so that there can be synergy in the processes and recommendation. That we do not report different to one committee than we do to the other. I answered the issue on workers being kept up to date of we can never communicate enough, and sometimes what we have to communicate is difficult, but we do ensure the committee that even more so after this question we will communicate even more so with the workers, first in through the formal structure of the unions, but also through the individual responses. Our doors will remain open for them. In respect of the questions asked by Honourable Lorima, I want to ask the provisional liquidators to just prepare to answer the first question on what is the workers' best case and worst case scenario at the end of the day. And then the fraud and corruption charges, I think I've adequately covered in what I've said. If more details required, I'm happy to, if one were to be just given a specific question, because if we could just get more specifics around the question. Are we talking about the fraud and corruption as against directors, as against other parties, and so on, so that one could say, of course, a report contains much detail, and then from that, the NBA will be finally making decisions on what cases to prosecute from the report, and what other cases to refer to the SIU. That final detail is not within Master's domain, but within the National Prosecuting Authority's domain. With regard to the claim against Mr. Motala, I wonder if my colleagues can perhaps help me with that, or if the provisional liquidators are a better position on that. And in the 2,000 litres, we've covered that in our response. Can I ask also for the provisional liquidators to just perhaps give an explanation, what do we want to achieve with the claims that we are instituting against the four major claims that we are, just perhaps a synopsis on that. If just for the liquidators, if Mrs. Sasser can cover us on the two aspects that we referred to.
I'm not quite sure which two were referred to me, but I think the one was Leifert Eitzig mine, the fact that the Bonners are involved in that mine. We don't have control as the master over the Bonners, because we appoint liquidators. Liquidators appointed in the matter are different from the ones that were appointed in Pamotzi. And it seems that they were also approached by a company, not specifically by the Barnards, and ultimately in the company was, the services of this company was utilized. It appears that the Barnards were involved in this
So at this point in time, what I understand, the contract has been cancelled with that company. I can't remember the name of that company. But be that as it may, it was the fact that the Barnards were involved in that company that ran the mine or managed the mine after the appointment is based, you know, it was not, the liquidators appointed in that matter was not familiar with the fact that the Barnards were involved. It only came out after they signed the contract. So I don't really know what, how I can deal with that. And it is definitely not in the master's domain. The second thing, why did it take so long to remove Mr. Matala? It seems to me that Mr. Matala was not investigated or nothing was happening. I came to the section in 2009 and then we got consent from Mr. Basson to investigate all liquidators that we had complaints about. And that is when the investigation started. It had nothing to do with Pamotzi. It's just a process that we started in 2009 and then ultimately ended up with the removal of certain, not only Mr. Matala, there are several other liquidators that were subsequently also removed. So I think that addresses the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue of the criminal cases that the liquidators have been instituting. Mr. Schmidt, you must remember that the Criminal Procedure Act entails that if you have two simultaneous and concurrent procedures, one in civil law, one in criminal law, the civil law one must be suspended until such time as the criminal proceedings have been completed. For the simple reason is that the accused cannot be expected in a civil forum to make admissions which may prejudice his criminal defense. So if we take these exact same facts and lay criminal charges against the directors, we won't see the inside of a civil courtroom for 10 years, which means the workers wait longer and longer and longer. That's why we have pursued the civil issue vociferously. And on these cases to be in court in 2.5 years, has caused both. That's correct. That's really correct. Secondly, on your question of what do the worker get, please bear in mind that the secured creditor's security clings to his assets. Assets are gone. They've been stolen. Or they've been sold. The secured creditor is now a concurrent creditor. So any monies that are going to be recovered, the preferred creditor, which is the workers, get first bite as that happened. Because the secured creditor's assets are no longer in existence, his security, likewise, is no longer in existence. Insofar as whatever was remained has been sold, yes, there he has a secured claim limited to the value of those claims. But these claims that we are instituting, the first bite there will be the workers. It won't be the secured creditor. The only person that the workers will be competing with will be the receiver of revenue, who is also a preferred creditor, and in certain circumstances ranks higher than they do. The preferred creditors of the workers, I think, have a preferred claim for 3 months' salary, limited to 24,000 or something like that, that's in the Act, and then such will get the proceeds there. We intend and hope to make a deal with the receiver to alleviate the plight of the workers, but we're not there yet because we haven't recovered anything. But to answer your questions, why are we doing this? The workers will get first. I must be constrained, however, just to tell everybody, you know, getting a judgment is one thing, getting money is another. We do not have a crystal ball. We don't know what will happen in the future. Mr. Basson was quite correct. Hindsight is 20/20 vision. If a potential defendant comes to us and says, I will give you 30 million, let me go, we will seriously consider that, even though the potential claim against him is 1.2 billion. Simply because we don't know what kind of asset he has. We don't know how long it's going to take an appeal procedure, perhaps, to finish. And the workers need money now. We obviously won't just accept it. We will consult with Master. We will consult with the unions. We will consult with the workers. But Mr. Basson is 100% correct. The law is not a scalpel. It's a broadsword. Take time.
and to get this thing through on this scale, we're excluding right now appeals. We might be in court in March, get a judgment, and then everybody knows an appeal, just like everybody's trying to rescind the August judgment. Then that puts me back 3 years. And in the meantime, we're not going anywhere. The legal bill keeps climbing. And what if we are successful? There's always a risk in litigation. I had an old law professor that says, if you want a guarantee, buy a microwave oven. You won't get one in law. And that is, if somebody comes to us with settlement, although on the face of it, it might look ridiculous, understand, we are trying to keep everybody's interests at odds. So I hope that answers the question.
Okay. Honorable Smith, I can see follow-up. I did make a promise. I'll keep my promise. Any other follow-up? Okay.
Thank you, Monsieur. The more I hear, the more intricate it becomes. But can I just ask two things? One is, in this process, there's a promotion. And the figure you raised, 400 million, 150 million, 70 million. Question is, where does it go? Has it gone to deal with Pomochi, the one of Pomochi, or the continuation of those affairs? Where is that money being allocated for purpose of your first liquidation distribution accounts? Where does it go? Does it move away or does it go Aurora away? That's my question. So, the second issue which I'd like to ask is, and I've forgotten what it was, but that's the one issue. The other issue was, I understand the notion of the value of the secured creditor, you say lie, if I follow you correctly, on the surface value of the surface of the buildings, of the assets, of the winding mechanism, of the shafts. But I don't think that's a full picture. My question is, you quite validly raised in your page 4 of this document, financial report to most group of companies. The value of a mine, predominantly, doesn't lie on the surface as it lies in the value of its proven reserves and the unproven resources. See, the value, at least here on page 4, you say the mine data for a purchase consideration of 5 million, because if there is 4.2 million ounces of proven reserves, the value of that property lies in its reserves, not in the surface stuff. So my question is, somewhere along the line, has to make some, I'm not sure who do these, and probably a chartered accountant who values and adds and subtracts and percentages. So I do not hear anything in this consideration about the underlying value of those, any of those assets, which are in its proven reserves. So I understand the figures are 4 million and the value, but there is a remaining value in those companies, and that's the proven reserves. How, this is a question of massive interest. How do you deal with that issue when, on the face of it, you've dealt with it as if it's a building, and now someone has destructed the building, and therefore the value is just in the remaining earth? Thank you.
Okay. You want to, I think the master wants to lead first.
Chair. I don't want to prejudice the provisional liquidators by letting them go first. I want to actually caution them that what they say will be recorded and we will hold them liable to whatever they say. Because what we have is a very challenging situation. This figure of 400 million, let us just take the 400 million, was based on an appraisement of the assets before any of the liquidation processes happened, and we then say to the liquidators, you were appointed in a state where there was 4 million in value. We now know there are sales of this one company for, or this one group of companies for 70 million and the other one for 100 million and so on. So we now know what has happened. There has been sales of the assets, and I think the majority of the assets are sold. The liquidators can confirm. The majority of the assets are sold. We just now deal with what has happened with the values in between. This figure is put up by the liquidators, and we then, as mastership in normal course of event, and this is to simplify, without prejudice of rights, and just as an example to the committee. You have a mine for 400 million, you've sold it for 70 million, therefore there's a loss of 330 million rand, therefore the surety of the liquidator must pay the money because the liquidator caused losses. It's a simple argument, and that's why we cannot at this point in time expect, unless they're willing to do so, for which I would be grateful, so that I can say, so I'm now suing you, or not suing them, it does not even, I go to your security and say, this is the loss of value, and this is for which the bond of security are going to be held liable. So in this final unraveling of the Bomoji issue, there's a lot of people that are coming under stink. It's the fraudsters who defrauded. There are directors of companies who are responsible for the conduct as directors. They are being held liable, have been held liable. There are the provisional liquidators that have certain assets and have made certain decisions which eventually. So all these processes, I give the House the assurance, is now under proper final scrutiny. The master is finally in the process of ascertaining exactly what the quantum is of the liability of provisional liquidators. And although the argument might be that I'm a good guy and you're a bad guy and that could occur, when you appoint liquidators, you are jointly and severally liable. And if you did not want to be in boat with that bad guy, you should not have been in that boat. Or you should have weeded out the bad guy. It's no problem. You're appointed jointly, you're held liable jointly, you're covered by a bond of security. If you are not clear on exactly what the quantum is, I can give you the assurance it's a matter that's currently under consideration. And we will take all facts into consideration in the final institution of the claim. It's extremely sensitive. They are extremely difficult concepts to deal with. But so that's for the value issue. In terms of the where the security lies and what has been secured in terms of deeds of surety or establishing a protection or a secured a right over assets, all the relevant facts have been taken into consideration. It's not just a surface issue, but whatever constitutes it. The provisional liquidator is quite correct. If that the asset is then no longer there, then the security is no longer there and you become a concurrent creditor. Most likely another issue for litigation, and we are in the process of going through that. Having said that, if the provisional liquidator was to help the house without prejudicing their position, they can do so now.
Thank you, Mr. Master. Now, Mr. Schmidt, unfortunately, I can't be assistant of this house because of my unwillingness, but the terms of that insurer include the term that the liquidators cannot make any admission or concession without their prior knowledge, because clearly it would potentially prejudice whatever defense they may have. So unfortunately, I'm precluded from responding to your question.
Okay. I'm quite dealing with a really, really learned friend. It's from one law to another. Look, I think we must appreciate the report that you've presented, and obviously, as a committee, we will have to look at it, what that becomes the way forward. I was just worried about one part from the provisional liquidator. That one that says before forensic that you were looking for funding. Now I'm asking myself, where will you be looking for funding?
because the risk might be you may look for funding somewhere where there's an interest, and but I will leave it because it's probably is not my thing on that part. But except to say that there has to be a way so that it can be settled. My fear is that if you fear to go deeper, it will be because of the cost implication and the recovery. We may not know what is the truth. And I think we all know issues of liquidation, they've got very serious limitations. As you have said, that the court can grant, and only to find out there's nothing. But I think the issue is that justice has to prevail. And I think on the point that you have raised, I think it's a matter that I always advise to say, make sure that you don't just consult with the structural arrangement. You do everything possible to even consult with those affected. But also you have to give some timeline lapse, because I've seen the experiences where settlements are made and people accept, and then they start to say, no, we're not aware that there was this settlement. A new family comes in, six, five, I'm not saying you can wait for 5 years or 6 years, but mechanisms on reaching consensus on what you have are quite critical, because divisions tend to emerge. Others can take even, I'm making an example, if others can take even 5,000 and say, I want to leave. Others will say, no, I'm not expecting proceed. So those processes themselves, at that current moment, where determination has to be made, are not easy. It's not a question of what does the majority say and the minority does say. I don't think there's a way of handling it, but even at the same time, we can't sit here and say that eventuality, we just wish that eventuality happens, because you may, as you said, it may run more than what we are sitting here. I think we will look on the issues. At least the master, I appreciate, we're not far from each other, me and you. Because you did make a concerning view that there is now, even in terms of the regulations, and also there is a process to look on the Insolvency Act. And I think we look on those things, but obviously we know that law may not necessarily fall in this committee. Only what this committee can do is to observe if there are gaps in the law, and then begin to then make a suggestion on processes on what is to be followed. I know we are dealing with quite a complicated, not just a scandal, but such a complicated matter. I don't know, I was counting how many cases you say you are handling. I'm not dealing with the cases on criminal matters, the ones that are waiting for proclamation for the FIU, and the ones on the NTPP. I was just looking at the cases in terms of the litigation processes. I'm sure we will also communicate. We will take your advice, and I think it's an appropriate one, that a proper observation can only be made post all these processes, where have been the gaps and so forth. I saw when you spoke there was some person from the DMR, and immediately you spoke, he packed up his things. We will deal with that. At least there's one left. No, there was another one next to you. We will deal with that, the issues of illegal mining. But I think also, sometimes I always say, sometimes it doesn't have to fight when, after fighting, you then ask yourself, what did you achieve? But I think we have to sit and look and talk to the department as to what are the low lapses that would have happened, even within this frame. Among other things is to look at the applications for licensing as to whether really the law is it as strict as it is. I'm just worried about even this exchange of papers, famous Aurora. I can't get a sense that we might have been at the DMR, we might have been in charge of that process. So I'm saying we can make that observation, not with the intention probably to pass, but to say there could be a better way. Whether you apply through the Companies Act or you apply through your MPRDA, which will make more control and authority from DMR rather than what you may be dealing with something else. Some simple things we will have, including the issue of security. Whether it should have been paid to other or it should have been used as a security catch, as a provision of license. And I think some of the discussions that we've made, we've said this issue of licensing is becoming is an issue that must now be considered quite strictly. So that at the, in the final analysis, and I think this is just one case now, in a, that is a living example, that in the final analysis, it will be so easy to guarantee you by writing the your social labor plans, because it's just something in writing. Can do anything. The lawyers probably down the line now are going to be making it very difficult to believe what they are writing. The only thing is that somebody must have something to lose in the event something goes wrong. So what you say in terms of your securing of bonds, it might be a matter now that even DMR takes into consideration the provision of mining licenses. So I think that's why I was asking the issue of the law, that not some of it, but we I think we take the note of what you could make. I think as a comment, we'll really, really appreciate. Although we can't know when will be that, it could mean after 5 years, 6 years from now, but we hope it will be much shorter. We can't comment, unfortunately, on the issues of gender, maybe the Justice Portfolio Committee. We deal with those issues, we can just observe. And honorable members, we have to make an opinion on the issue of the panel of liquidators. But told now you said there are 500 or 700. 57, yes, that are on your website. I think it will help properly. I can't say only the, it will help on our case, it might help the department to have the list of that those panels. I think that's what we could recommend to the department. It must help, if we have to retrieve it for them, we can do it. It's not a difficulty. They must have the list so that in the process of matters of this nature comes in, they can do checks whether those people fall in that category. Unfortunately, the human being is not a stone. You say a stone, you leave it here, it will be like this. Even in that 5-7, we can't say it because you just live on. I always say, don't trust a human being, believe in a human being. So we can't say that 5-7 can't do this thing. I agree with you 100%. But for now, we think that excellent balance is in place. So thank you very much with your presentation. I don't want to leave honorable members on what now we. I know there were some honorable members who made their suggestions, which I don't think they are suggestions that are one. I think is it honorable Mafolo that we support this process and we say proceed. Yes, proceed with caution, but with the necessary required speed so that justice can prevail. So you've got all the support of the committee with regards to that. Yes, we want to see closure on the matter because it's a serious matter that affects quite a number of many lives of our people. So I thought that's what Honorable Mafono was presenting to the House. And also to say that on that issue, we hope, you said that you gave us a hope and then you, later on you seem to have doubts. The MTPP and the SIU, that although it might have fallen on our area, but we will make means that we act what of the process. And I think we will support even that process that is being undertaken as a committee to make sure that there is compliance with the law. I may have forgotten there was another, which is something more of a review or a recommendation that came from members. But I don't think we will also doubt to support the initiative that you have taken to clean up. I think we must welcome that, to clean up your data of liquidators to make sure that you've got credible individuals that are sitting there. I think that one we will accept. I don't think the committee will. But is there any other matter, honourable members, on this matter? Honourable Smith?
I think it probably would be in the hand of the master, but to report to us in due time if there's something tangible has happened. In other words, keep us informed. Thank you.
But I think also the we know it's going to be a problem for you. Maybe the process of cleaning. We must also have a process because some of us have fallen victims of this. They're blacklisting some of those. Not just to, because they may come back. So there must be a way of cleaning that. I think we must agree, committee members. There is no doubt. We can't wait for the master to give us observation on a... I think one of the things that probably we have to communicate in the department is to say, based on this experience and this exercise, is there a way that consideration is being made? I think on the committee side, of making sure that incidents or occurrences of this nature don't... One of the things that will not happen, but as a learning curve, that is a process that needs to tighten up, because it happened in this setting. It didn't happen somewhere else, our own set. So I think that one, I don't think it will be a difficult thing, or to recommend that consideration be made on improving on the legislation to make sure that we avoid some of the similar incidents from taking place, besides the issue of the list of liquidation that must be provided. Would that not suffice, Honourable Lorimer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I fully concur. I just like to know from the department. I'm not sure how we asked, whether we ask them next time they come or what. What steps have they taken, if any, to stop happening again? And also, particularly with reference to Blobel. What happened there? How come the whole thing is we're seeing a bit of a rerun of the same thing?
Okay, I think we can do it both ways. First is to talk about the need, whether is there a process to look or review the law so that incidences like that one, promotion and pay for, do not happen. If there, that process is there a process currently or an intention to look at that, based on the experiences of the two incidences. I think that suffices. We can write to them on behalf of the committee. Okay, you are doing very well. Now, can we, or you want to continue now? I don't want you to make consensus by fatigue. Can you take a 10-minute stretch break? We will come back with the minutes and then you leave. Okay, can we focus on the minutes? October. No, they're not correct. Yeah. 15 October. Page 1. Correction on Matala, as usual. Then from there onwards it becomes mutandis. Yeah, that's what they're saying now. You see? The laymen won't understand the language. Okay, page 2. page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Page 7.
There is page 7.
Now, only myself, Honorable Piginini, Honorable Lorima, Honorable Schmidt, not by liking, but by design, can move these minutes. The rest can watch us. So the authority is on us. Honorable Smith?
I move, Mr. Chair. For the election.
Honorable Piginin?
Thank you very much. I wish to second you, Chair.
Okay. Matters arising. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6.
It's still going to be packed.
Done. Let me put aside. 17 October. Now. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Done. Now, this is not even shrinkage. We're beyond the slender. Only me and Comrade Piginini can move these minutes. You can watch us.
Chair, I think we need a little opinion to establish whether two members can form a committee meeting.
Don't worry. No, I can move this one from the chair. Honorable Piginini.
Thank you very much. I wish to second you, Chair. This is a really true action.
Matters arising. I can see others are shivering. Page 1. Page 2. page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Done. Perfect. Now it is better to look better. 22 October. Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Oh, Father Bushmith.
Mr. Chair, provided you on the 22nd of October 2014 minutes, and you pass page, I think it's page 3, paragraph 2.1, says the committee expressed concern on the increase in deficit. It says the increased in deficit. Maybe just a spelling mistake. Page 3, paragraph 2.1, first bullet.
But first dealing with the correction, then the minute. Was on 5. But, let it play. It does have a reverse gear. Okay. So we have to be pushed. Page 6. Okay, that has arisen. I wanted to, yes,
Mr. Chair, somewhere Mr. Lorimer and I left the meeting just before the State Diamond Trader. We would like to have that noted somewhere in here, Mr. Chair. Was it there?
Yes.
Did I miss it? Sorry, my apology.
On page 4,
first paragraph, first sentence. So, just explain it again.
Honorable, what?
Chairperson, on that page 4, there was no discussion. We didn't discuss whether he should leave the meeting or not, he just left.
Now, it depends on the interpretation, because there was a proposal of the day, and there was a discussion, there was a decision that we will allow, the issue was about whether state demonstrator presents or not. But the issue was that if they present, they must first answer that question. And having dealt with that issue to say, they will, in the process of presentation, can start with the question that was asked first, then that's when they said, in that context, they will not be part of the meeting, because in their view, first thing was that they must respond. So there was a discussion on the matter. But it may not necessarily, we can find a way of changing it. It may not necessarily be a discussion about the DA leaving or staying in the meeting. That one I can, it was about the response that was wanted. So we can find a way of correcting that. Yeah. Okay, let's start page one, matters arising. Page two. Page three. Page four. Page five. Page six. And you.
Question, Mr. Chair, as to whether the state arbitrator has responded in writing as per the request.
I received the information from the secretary this morning. I can confirm that I have not seen it in writing, but we will have to deal with it. It will be presented in the next meeting. It's going to be an issue on the agenda. I can confirm that. But I must say also, honorable members, is a matter that I think one will have to take up. You see, this thing of meeting deadlines sometimes is problematic, because one of the issues we raise as observation is the turnaround time of the entities. See, if you say this date and you make sure that you do it, you can't do it prior to that date, you do it exactly on the date. It's a compliance issue. But I think it's a matter that we'll have to find a way to handle. But I can say I've not seen it, but we'll look at it. You'll recall also that what we said, I think that's what may be missing. What we said was that if that matter, if when we don't think so, rather than to carry, not process, if that matter raises a legal issue, we will also take that issue and ask the parliamentary legal unit, so that when we present it here, we present the goals with what we would have done. So that's what we will do. Okay. Any other matters arising on page? Six. Okay. In the absence of any matter, means we dispose of this minute of the 24th. We didn't move, and you allowed us to cause to matter arising. You're in a hurry. Okay, who moves this minute? Honorable Mafalo?
Chairperson, I move for adoption of the minutes.
Any seconder? Honorable Mandela?
I second
move by Honorable Mafo.
Honorable Mandela records the minutes of the 21st, 21st page 2 page 3 testing, still up. Any mover of the minutes? Honorable Mandela?
Thank you, Chair. We move the adoption of the minutes of the 24th of October
2014. Any seconder?
Thank you, Chair. I wish a second.
It's like signing a bilateral agreement. Minutes of the 29th October. Page 1. Eh? It's on 11. Page 1. Page 2, page 3, Honorable Mandela.
Thank you, Chair. Can it be noted on point number 4, adoption of oversight report to Gauteng Province? It is Mr. ZMD, not MZD, Bandel, who moved for the adoption. Thank you, Chair.
Noted. Now, any mover of the minute? Honorable Mashala?
Yes, Chair, I move for the adoption of the minutes as the true reflections of what the committee has discussed. Thank you.
Okay, any seconder? Honorable Mandela?
Thank you, Chair. Second, the move for the adoption of the minutes of the 29th of October 2014. Thank you.
Any matters arising, page 1? Page 3. Okay, done. Now, can we go to announcements? I think there are only three announcements. The first one is that the trip for the oversight still remains. And we propose that we'll be leaving on the 23rd, né? Until, and then start on the 24th until the 28th. Then we will forward, honorable members, probably we'll give the concrete. But the only day that might be a little bit sticky for all of us is Monday. But we hope we will succeed for the Monday, and then we will come and present the actual areas of attention in the Platinum Belt. That is the first issue, the oversight visit of the committee. The second one is that probably we'll also bring it here, is the program for 2015 up to the third quarter, which is around August, is out. We will make the recommendation because it starts with the committee work. And we wanted to suggest again that period that we do an override. We will come and present again here what has to be done. So that is the announcement. Last announcement is that you are released. Don't worry. Your meeting is adjourned.